All right, we're going to continue in our study on the English Civil War. We ended up last time at the end of the Second Civil War. There were two civil wars back to back as Charles was seeking to gain back his authority, raised up these bad folks to stand with him. They were put down. He was held under house arrest more than in prison. He escaped to set up another revolution, the Second Civil War, and once again he ended up in a house arrest and in custody of the Parliament. But the struggle in Parliament at this stage was, what do we do next? It was almost like the dog that caught the car, you know. It's kind of, now what? What do we do now? And from our vantage point, we kind of look back and maybe we quickly evaluate the whole situation in Britain there and say, well, it's pretty obvious what they should have done, but it really wasn't simple for them to think through these issues. Putting a king on trial was unprecedented. It was something that was just beyond the scope of their thinking. As Robertson says in his book, there was no available blueprint for the trial of Charles I. There were many precedents for treason trials, followed by sentences of death by beheading for aristocrats or by disemboweling for common traitors. Remember William Wallace? They killed him by disemboweling him, cutting his stomach open and letting his innards all fall to the ground. And then they sometimes would light those innards while you were still looking at your stomach and everything lying on the ground. They would set fire to them. So the trial of the monarch was a constitutional conundrum. There was no court in place to do this, and also there was a legal problem due to the established mindset of the king being above the law. So they had that mindset, so how do we even go forward? It required immense effort for people to overcome the presumption that rex is lex, that king is law. It was a huge hurdle to cross. How do you put the king on trial when the king is law? How do you do that? How does the king judge the king? When everything the king does in the first place is the definition of law, you can see their struggle. In the Magna Carta, back in 1215, King John had made a guarantee to the barons that they would only be judged by their peers and not by the king. So it kind of gave them a bit more confidence that they would be judged by, like we have in our country, by our peers. However, as understood at the time, this meant that the king also had a right to be tried by his peers, but a king could not, by definition, have any peers. Who's going to try the king in a country? So it was vital that solutions to these paradoxes and problems had to be found quickly if the king was to be brought to trial. The longer it took to resolve these problems, the closer the Third Civil War came, because Charles didn't stop his wheeling and dealing. Now you had this, remember we saw last time, we had this clash in Parliament where you had the Presbyterian MPs were kind of more partial to side with the king than the independents. They were more afraid of the independents than they were of the king. And those MPs at that stage wanted to continue negotiating with the king. And the independents are saying, the king has so violated law, he is guilty. How do we negotiate with somebody who's up to his eyeballs in violation of the law? And so they excluded them from Parliament at one stage in order to take a vote so that they could stop negotiations with the king. But these MPs were still opposed to the trial of the king. So they were holding to the position that the king's wrongdoing had come about due to being misled by evil counselors. So he wasn't personally guilty. He had received bad counsel. And so these Presbyterian MPs rested their case of not putting the king on trial. They rested this on David's words when David was talking about King Saul. And he said, who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? And so that was their kind of basis of their argument against putting the king on trial. Now, the new model army under Cromwell and General Fairfax, they had sent a delegation or a diplomatic mission to The Hague. And when this mission returned, they had bad news with them. And that bad news was that the Dutch were entering into a commercial alliance with the pro-Charles leaders in Ireland. On the same day, Cromwell spoke to the two leading parliamentarian lawyers, Whitelock and Widdrington, about the trial of the king. And these men were extremely negative about this. They said there were serious legal issues in putting the king on trial. So they were opposing Cromwell at that point. I think it was at that point that Cromwell began looking further afield to find some legal counsel that could help them in their case, and had the courage to go against the king. And the king, with his high-powered council and all his advisors, he was still receiving visitors and had this, he wasn't a prisoner by any means, had access to people. It was restricted, but he still had access, and his defense team was giving him advice. And his conclusion and position was that, what is the law if the person questioned is without peer? So he's jumping onto the Magna Carta and saying, I have no peers, I cannot be tried. The only way to try a king is with his peers. If you're going to go by law, if you want the Magna Carta, then that's what we have to do. And so he continued to try and restore himself to his position of complete authority. So now Parliament was facing, as all this is unfolding, they're trying to come up with a way to put the king on trial. They're fighting within their own ranks because there's many in their ranks that don't want to assist in this. You've got lawyers that are reluctant, that are fleeing, that are not prepared to get involved through fear. But you've got externally now, you've got huge developments that are on the horizon, and Parliament is looking at these things. Cromwell is watching these things transpire. You've got the Royalist army that was still in Ireland, who had joined now with the Catholic resistance army that was in Ireland. So before, the Royalist army in Ireland was fighting against the Catholic resistance army. Now the Royalist army was still in Ireland, and they're making friends with the Catholic resistance army in order to support the king against Parliament. And so you've got them joining up there, along with the part of the English fleet. Navy had defected with the fall of Charles, and they had gone to Holland, and they now were coming back into the sway and joining up with the Prince of Wales, who was going to take command of the Navy. And so you got the Prince of Wales, who was Charles's son, and they are coming together. And so you've got their Navy, which was really 2 days' sail away from the mainland. You've got Ireland that's bubbling. Wales and I could come into the sway, so they could take Wales there. But you've also got this agreement between the Dutch and the Catholic grouping now in Ireland, where they've got this agreement, which means suddenly this brings in the potential that the Dutch Navy, which was highly feared, or was a highly efficient Navy, could be sucked into this whole thing as well. You could have even the Dutch Navy joining up. And so Parliament is saying, we just, the Third Civil War is about to unleash, and we can't even sort out this thing. The longer the king is left in limbo like this, the more dangerous it becomes for everyone. So Cromwell was desperately trying to pull together a legal team, and he called for a meeting with the top legal people, parliamentary people, and Parliament's legal clerk, or clerk, Henry Elsing, refused to be involved and claimed to be sick. He said, no, I'm sick, I can't come. And when the two greatest lawyers, that I've already mentioned, Whitlock and Widdrington, received the message to come and prepare the king's trial, they literally jumped in carriages and fled into the country and went into hiding. They were not prepared to touch this thing. And so there, Parliament is standing. We have many hurdles to try and climb. Now, Parliament determining to put the king on trial was indeed a very noble way to deal with the problem of Charles I. There were many ways to eliminate a king, many ways to get rid of him. Poison him, assassinate him, he fell off his horse on a ride, he fell down the stairs, he was trying to escape and he got shot trying to escape. You know, I mean, there's a ton of ways that you can remove the problem. But they decided not to, and the new army actually protected him very diligently and very faithfully until law could deal with him. And so we're seeing the character that is coming out through Cromwell and his forces here. as they were really wanting to function in terms of law. They wanted an open and a public trial because their goal was really generational reformation. That's what they wanted. They wanted to demonstrate the rule of law. They wanted to show, be seen doing and exalting the importance of the rule of law. So they wanted to make generational change, and they wanted true long-term protection of liberty and law itself. And so that's what they were trying to uphold, despite the fact that in trying to do that, they risked so much more. They had so much more to lose. They said the king's trial was not to be done in a corner. This was God's work, and it would be done in the sight of God. And so the choice of an open trial, this open trial procedure, was not merely to conform with the common law and to deter future tyrants. It was to allow the world to witness the righteousness of their cause and to let history judge the strength of their case. It's a quote from Robertson. There was also another legitimate route that the army chose not to take and thus avoided, another route they could have chosen to take and thus avoid this troublesome, unprecedented public trial of the king. Because the position of their thinking at that stage, which was correct according to law, the common law, according to international law, was any leader of your enemy's forces, if you defeated the enemy and captured their leader, the army could court-martial that person and put him immediately in front of a firing squad and execute him. And the king was the leader of the forces that had rebelled against Parliament. Parliament had defeated him. They had captured him. They could have court-martialed him and executed him. And they said, no, we're not going to do that because we want this to be seen by the world to be in line with law. Because the saying is, a man who is dead renews no war. And so let's get rid of this guy. That was the thinking in the military terms. If you've got this military leader that's creating war. So whether they were right or wrong, whether they should have done that, they had the right to do it, but they decided not to do it. And I think in many ways, in God's providence, I think we benefit from that. As I think a lot of things came out in the thinking, forced them to cross bridges and think through issues that we continue to benefit from in our day. A public trial was chosen even though there was no example to suggest that the trial of a head of state was even feasible. To do so, as we said, lawyers had to be found that could make it work. But as we have also seen, most of the prominent lawyers just melted into the air. Cromwell's chaplain, Hugh Peters, knew a lawyer by the name of John Cook. And this is the man who, with great courage, integrity, and determination, stepped up to the task of building the legal case against the king. And this man is really a giant in my mind. And practically unknown. I mean, you'll pick up some history books that even talk about the trial and you won't even see his name, which is staggering. Cook's case rested upon the belief that the king was not above the law. He had been thinking a lot, he had been wrestling with issues, and he had come to this understanding in his legal studies and in his debates with people about what was taking place in England at the time, that the king was not above the law. Cook had spent time in Geneva and had been obviously wrestled with the issue there in Geneva as well. This was after Calvin, but still you had good reformed tradition there. This principle, though maybe missed by many, had not escaped Cook when Parliament had overturned the king's ship money. Remember, the king had put all this ship tax. Everybody in the country had to pay this tax and build a ship for the king, every county, instead of just the coastal counties as the law had made it. And then this had been challenged, and when Parliament had come back into sitting, they had overthrown this law. They had reversed it and said it's not binding, which immediately was an indicator, which not many people picked up in that day, but it was an indicator that the law is above the king. Now, nobody spelled that out, but the mere fact that Parliament had overturned the king's issuing of this law proclaimed that, and Cook didn't miss that. The Magna Carta had promised the barons that they would be tried by their peers. Now, Cook was wrestling with this, and he's starting to try and think legally about it, and what was the meaning and the intention and the purpose. And Cook argued that it would not breach the spirit of this great charter to try the king before a distinguished and representative a group of judges as Parliament could put together. So he's saying, well, the issue here is law. The issue here is justice. The issue is the security of the country. We're not violating the Magna Carta. You could disagree with that, but he concluded we're not violating the Magna Carta if we can put together with integrity a just and noble group of people elected by Parliament to evaluate and sit on this case. Also, it had not gone unnoticed by Cook when Parliament had charged Stafford. If you remember the case with Stafford, they charged him with treason and put him to death. And eventually the king had to sign an agreement with this, and he did so, and they executed Stafford. But in signing this agreement, what the king, unbeknown to him, unbeknown to most people at the time as well, when that actually happened, was they had broadened the definition of treason wide enough that was going to entrap Charles. And nobody kind of picked it up at the time, but they had said treason is not only violence or rejection or undermining of the king, it is also violence against the state. And the king had signed that. And so treason would include now any intention to destroy the state, to destroy the nation. So on January the 10th, 1649, Cook was made the Solicitor General, and on him fell the task of devising some lawful, fair, and presentable way to prosecute Charles I. The Royalists said that Parliament had no authority to proceed along such lines. First, because the King was untouchable. And secondly, because such things were passed in a purged Commons, and they were not ratified by the House of Lords. So it was a purged Commons, and the House of Lords hadn't ratified it. What happens when the legal system is used to undermine and hinder the real application of law and justice? This is the issue that the English Parliament, or the Cromwell and his men, are now facing. What happens when the law procedures undermine true justice and true law? And you get caught up, as we see many times in our own political system, you get caught up in procedures. And that is in the name of, well, this is what's written in the thing with respect to procedural things. This is how the procedure goes. Okay, and so it's always a difficult thing to weigh up and evaluate those things. And this is where they found themselves. Let's think of our history. The American War of Independence, or the American Revolution, whichever side you're on. How they got stuck in the procedures. They were tied into the British parliamentary king procedures, and they worked with that. And nothing was happening. They were blocked. So what do you have to do? You've got to function outside that in the parameters of law. You still want to hold to law. You want to have some law way of functioning, but you've got to have a way to counter that. Otherwise, you're caught up in the procedure. And the system, and when a system becomes thoroughly corrupt, how do you deal with it? And so those are really things that are never going to leave us as we live this life until Christ comes, as we wrestle in our own context. When a system becomes so thoroughly corrupted, what happens? How do you do and respond to stuff? Let's say you get a Supreme Court in our country that's 85% complete revisionist understanding of the Constitution. It's a living document, and we change it at will, however we interpret. And every time you got a court case that goes all the way up, bam, you get to that, you know, you're never going to get anywhere. How do you work with that? We have to wrestle with it. I don't have an answer, but we have to be thinking about these kinds of things in our day and age, just as they had to do it in their day and age. And so the Royalists, despite the fact of the glaring tyranny of the absolute chaos that King Charles had caused, with the untold thousands that had lost their lives and the destruction of the nation, procedurally, they're refusing to acknowledge this law that is being set up to put him on trial, because it didn't go through all the channels that they know would completely block the ability to bring justice. The true intent and purpose of law cannot be thwarted by insisting upon procedures that have no intention of upholding the law. That Charles was responsible for waging war against his own people was a matter of historical record.
as Robertson says.
True Law clearly condemned Charles as a treasonous tyrant, and yet the royalists were appealing to these procedures to protect him. The fundamental responsibility of any government is the protection of its people and the maintaining of justice. King Charles cared very little about the people, and his supporters were incapable of defining true justice. The army and the purged parliament did truly care for the people and nation, and Sir General Fairfax declared martial law to enable those elected representatives of the people who would legislate with the nation's true interests at heart. He protected them in their positions of ruling. This was an emergency. It was a case of extreme necessity. But as Robertson says, it is a mistake to think that necessity knows no law. It calls for a different kind of law. The army and its supporters rejected a lawless solution, assassination, and they declined the lawful but summary justice available under the martial law, which permitted the enemy commanders to be put before the firing squad. They were attempting to demonstrate their legality. They were functioning a different law, but they were trying to bind themselves to law. And so we see them desperately trying to do that. And they did this by pointing to the concept of representative government, which they claimed meant that the commons was able to make law without the assent of either the king or the lords. And here's the legal basis as quoted in Robertson. This was the thinking that was supporting those people at this stage. And this is the quote. The commons of England, assembled in Parliament, declare that the people under God are the origin of all just power. They do likewise declare that the commons of England, assembled in Parliament, being chosen by and representing the people, have the supreme authority of this nation. They do likewise declare that whatsoever is enacted and declared law by the commons of England, assembled in Parliament, has the force of law, and all the people of this nation are included thereby. Although the consent and the concurrence of the King and the House of Peers, that's the House of Lords, be not had thereunto. So we're saying that even though the King and the House of Lords are not consenting, the majority of this country is made up of the common people, and they've elected the House of Commons, who's sitting together in Parliament. We think we have a basis to make law. So this is an emergency situation. How do we solve the stalemate? How do we move on? You can wrestle with that in your own mind. You can try and work through. But that was their position. And what Parliament did was they nominated 135 men to sit as jurors. These were exceptional people as far as standing in society, as far as positions, as far as understanding. And they elected them to sit as functioning as jurors. They weren't called jurors, but in the king's trial. These people assumed their positions voluntarily. I know a few of them later on, when Charles II came back to power, they kind of backtracked from there. But the majority said, no, we did that, and we stand by what we did. But anyway, at the time, they all said, yes, we voluntarily come forward. You've called us, we will respond, just like us being called up for jury duty. And they assumed their positions voluntarily and from a sincere conviction that no other course was open to them as God-fearing Christians and lovers of their country. What else can we do? We find ourselves in this emergency. How do we go forward? The indictment drawn up by John Cook was headed a charge of high treason and other high crimes. So he had to pull this together. He had to try and make a legal case that could be held up in a court of law. So Cook wrote that he wrote what is a good definition of the king's responsibilities. Okay, this was part of his charges against the king, but he started off by laying out what the king should do. Trusted with a limited power to govern by and according to the laws of the land and not otherwise, and by his trust, oath, and office being obliged to use the power committed to him for the good and benefit of the people, and for the preservation of their rights and liberties. That's what the king should be doing. He's given authority, it's limited, he can only use that, no more. And it's for the protection of the people. Cook's understanding was that the king couldn't encroach upon traditional liberties or breach the common law. I think our constitution is set up in the same kind of way. The federal government is given responsibilities, and only what's been delegated to it can it do. It can't now step out of that and encroach in other areas because it does not have the authority. It's not given to them. And so that's basically was Cook's point. As Robertson says, the notion that the monarch's power was held in a trust and could only be exercised for the benefit of the people's liberty was new. This was a completely new one. This is what the king's authority was about. It was given in a trust. And the king, according to Cook's charge, was a tyrant because he waged aggressive war against his own people for his personal advancement rather than the public interest. In seizing unlimited power to rule according to his royal will rather than law, and in particular, in abolishing the most precious of the people's fundamental rights, namely access to frequent parliaments to remedy grievances. Cook's charge continued, saying, "Much innocent blood of the free people of this nation has been spilt. Many families have been undone. The public treasury wasted and exhausted. Trade obstructed and miserably decayed. Vast expanses and damage to the nation incurred, and many parts of this land spoiled, some of them even to desolation. Charles Stuart has been and is the occasioner, author, and continuer of the said unnatural, cruel, and bloody wars, and therein guilty of all the treasons, murders, rapines, burnings, spoils, desolations, damages, and mischiefs to this nation, acted and committed in the said wars or occasioned thereby." Cook ended his charge by saying, "And the said John Cook, on behalf of the people of England, does, for the said treasons and crimes, impeach the said Charles Stuart as a tyrant, traitor, murderer, and a public and implacable enemy to the Commonwealth of England, and prays that the said Charles Stuart, King of England, may be put to answer all and every of the premises, and that such proceedings, examinations, trials, sentences, and judgments may thereupon..." I miswrote something there. "Sentences must thereupon be judged or be handled and shall be agreeable to justice, so it all might be carried out in a just way." Robertson says, "Irrespective of views as to whether the king could or should be put on trial, there was incontrovertible evidence that he bore primary responsibility for the death and desolation of the two civil wars." John Cook was an extremely brave and just man. We might think it strange how the people in those days struggled with coming to terms with the idea that the king was not above the law. But I think our generation has come to terms and accepted the fact that the federal government is above the law, and they can act and do exactly what they want, contrary to law, and very few people in our nation raise an eyebrow. We have so forgotten the meaning of the Constitution, we have so forgotten the meaning of law, and we really don't even know what justice means and liberty. And so we have this tyrannical federal government, in many ways comparable to Charles, that is acting way above the law, and for the most part we are sitting as most of the English people were sitting in that day and saying, well, that's just how it is. That's just what government is like. That's just what the king does. And so in that sense, I think studying the English Civil War helps us to realize and at least identify the fact that, well, you know, we might be as blind as they were. And it also gives us some mechanism for starting to think in our own context about what is the meaning of law, how do we define it, and how do we uphold that with respect to the position that the king should have. Is the king above the law? Is the federal government above the law? Can they just create any agency they want? Can they enforce any way they want? Can they do whatever they want? Or are they bound to law? And that's a long way back for us, I think, because we've moved so far from that thinking or even realization that it is a problem. But as we continue to look at the way the people in Cromwell's time try to deal with these issues, and they certainly were very diligent in trying to hold to the law. And I think that at least helps us, even if we disagree with things they did, at least it helps us in our understanding of, as we try and bring solutions to our days. As Christians, we ought to realize that legal innovation is no more authoritative than religious innovation. So as we look at the Pope and we look at people bringing religious innovation in the name of Christ, we should be thinking about all legal innovation in the same way. And as Americans, we've got God's law, which is supreme, but we have a constitution that is a very good document, and it gives us a body of law for our nation that is sound and that is worth standing for and upholding. And when we see innovation with that document, we need to treat it like we would treat religious innovation in our churches. It should not be granted quarter. It should not be tolerated. So may the Lord give us wisdom, and may He have mercy on our nation as we seek to uphold law as the basis of liberty, as opposed to men's ideas and emotional outbursts.